It's the New Mercury Podcast, and here's your host, Kyle A. Lohmeyer.
Hello, and welcome to the New Mercury Podcast. I am your host, Kyle A. Lohmeyer, the proprietor and sole original content provider to thenewmercury.com, which is still accessible in this post-net neutrality age despite being the least popular website in the entire world. So, the idea here was to launch a podcast as an extension of my blog. I've been writing all my life, so blogging is actually kind of easy for me. This whole talking to myself for several minutes on end thing is something rather new, though, so try to bear with me. The bulk of my preparation for doing a podcast came from Google searches and from listening to a handful of podcasts myself, and that's really about it. I'll be honest, the idea of a podcast itself is just a bit backward to me. I almost never watch a State of the Union address, for example, because I know by the next morning one or probably all of the major news networks or outlets will have had an intern transcribe the entire thing and post it online for me to read at my leisure, minus all the sickening pauses for applause. So it's great. I'm a guy who likes to read things, preferably on ink and paper, but, you know, that's increasingly difficult these days. So then imagine my surprise when I find out most people would actually rather watch and or listen to something than read it, which explains why my blog's following is growing so slowly, and that mostly based on the memes, I think. So all right, we're doing a podcast. As you can see, you can't see, it's a podcast. I don't have a fancy studio here. I just have my office in my home, which is near a municipal airport, and where my neighbors have, you know, lawn care appointments scheduled, you know, whenever during the day, and where my 10-pound dog lives, who's very territorial and must bark at anything she sees outside. So perfection from an audio standpoint isn't going to be attainable. Plus, I've got a face for radio, and as you can tell, a voice for print. And the equipment, per se, is very low-tech and even lower budget. But I will do my best to fight through these hurdles and produce something that hopefully doesn't grate too hard upon the ear. So again, the idea was to do a podcast that's an extension of the blog, which has been around now for a couple of years and has hundreds of posts. I mean, there's a couple of novels worth of prose out there. So where to begin with all that? So I decided probably the best bet would just be to get the talk about the blog itself a little bit first here, and its aim and purpose, and we'll start with the name. Clever and astute readers will have picked up on the fact that it's an homage to H.L. Mencken, who spent most of his career writing for the Baltimore Sun and then launched a magazine called The American Mercury. And, well, he's dead, and that magazine's now long gone. So this is the New Mercury. A couple of things about Mr. Mencken. He wrote in the early 20th century. That was the bulk of his career. Said some very unfortunate and foolish and wrong things about black people, like us all. He had the misfortune of not being right about everything all the time, and of being a product of the era in which he lived and wrote, again, the early 20th century. I think on balance, the brilliance of everything he wrote makes it so that I don't see why he cannot be forgiven the wrong things he said, given that the things he said that were correct were so correct that they're still true and applicable a century later in some cases. So I think he can be forgiven his racist commentaries that unfortunately went along with his straight up brilliant ones. So anyway, that's settled. As far as where the real meat and potatoes of this podcast should begin with, I suppose, is the best place, just the most helpful kind of first inaugural podcast would be maybe to just start with a description of the kind of jaded and jaundiced way I look at the world, because it is from this cynical perspective that I write my blog entries, I make the memes, and it's from that same perspective I'll be narrating these ramblings from. A big point of my perspective is that there's this world that we're shown, and then there's the world as it actually is. And when you think about it, when you just ask yourself, you know, what do I know? Who told me that? The things you know. Think of the things you know. And ask yourself, you know, how do I know this? Who told me this? And when you boil it down and get right down to it, the world you know is largely shaped by, you know, a handful of influences. It starts with really the people you know and the people around you in your life, your friends, your family, your coworkers, your schoolmates, professors, whatever. And then outside of that, there's, you know, the media and the social media that we have now. And all these, particularly the media, the mainstream media, you know, have worked to influence your opinions on things. And then above that's the government, which is much more responsible for shaping the media and its messages than you might suspect, and than anybody would like to think, actually. I mean, let's all try to remember that the New York Times, all the news that's fit to print, the old gray lady sat on the Ed Snowden story for over a year and didn't release it, and only printed it when the two reporters that did most of the work on that story got together, wrote a book about that story, and were going to release the book that the New York Times decided it did not want to be scooped by a book, and so released the story it had sat on for a year. And it was an eventful year that they sat on that story. We had an election. George W. Bush won and was able to continue his wars in Iraq and Afghanistan without anybody knowing that the government was conducting a wholesale surveillance on us without any of us knowing about it. And so that was, you know, that was nice. So if you know, if things like that happen, and it did, then I think one would be rather foolish to not assume that this sort of thing goes on quite a lot more often, and for reasons even probably more nefarious. The little bits of the government that dirty stuff that they let us see, that gets out for us to see, I mean, is, you have to imagine, it's just the tip of the iceberg. And so anyway, so getting back to what you know, right, this world that we are presented now, you know, these are all, you know, there's only a handful of influencers that are in your day-to-day life, and they're all kind of influenced by the same thing, right? We all went to schools, for most of us anyway, went to government-run public schools. And it's not by accident the government decided ages ago it was very important that they take over writing the curriculum and deciding what it is the kids are taught. So that's the world we know. And it's very insular. We don't see, the news doesn't bother telling you what's going on outside, much of what's going on outside our own country, and not even a lot of what's going on inside of it. Just, you know, what they want us to know, what it behooves them for us to know, what it behooves the government for us to know. So that's the world we know. And then there's the real world outside of that we don't know about. And I don't know everything about it all, okay? I'm not going to sit here all Alex Jones and tell you I've got it figured out and it's all some globalist conspiracy involving fluoridated water, vaccines, and chemtrails. Because I don't believe it's any of those things. I mean, there might be a little iota of truth in there somewhere about the globalist aspect, because obviously, you know, the corporatist oligarchs that run our government have ties all over the world and aren't all of them necessarily even American citizens. But yeah, I mean, you know, that other, you know, gay frog stuff we're not getting into. And likewise, I'm gonna get out in front of this right now, because I know a lot of people on the left like to automatically equate anybody who would wear something like an Anarchy Ball t-shirt, which again, you can't see that I'm wearing right now because it's a podcast, is, you know, a Nazi and a fascist. And so I'm very much not going to sit here and tell you this is some international Jewish conspiracy to destroy whiteness or cause a white genocide or any of that other ridiculous nonsense that the alt-right likes to go on about. I tell you, it's pretty much almost a tie, a dead heat between, you know, these alt-right fascist Nazi imbeciles and these, you know, self-styled Antifa people who are the most annoying in the political realm these days. I mean, it's, when they get together for these rallies, I kind of cynically wish they'd actually kill each other off completely, and then the problem would go away. But, you know, they typically just throw things at each other and some windows get broken. But anyway, what I will tell you, though, is that when you look at our government from the way that the government taught you to look at it, you know, in school, which perpetuates the self-serving lie the government teaches everybody, that they need government, right? That's the one thing the government teaches you in government school, is that you actually need the government. And rest assured, the one you have is actually the best kind there is. So at least there's that. And the kind there is, they tell you, is that we are a representative democracy with a capitalist economy. And that's not actually true, you see. What we are in reality is our government is structured as a corporatist oligarchy, and these are not the same things. You know, as a representative democracy, most especially, it's not capitalism. That's a thing. You know, all these college professors and media types and the opinion leaders of the left, they all like to point to capitalism as being this evil thing. And when you try to pin them down and get an example of what it is, show me on this doll where capitalism hurt you, they point to an ouchie caused by corporatism, not capitalism. Okay, and explain what corporatism is. It's basically a situation you get where when you have a government that is powerful enough to give corporations the things they would want, like legislate their competitors out of business or legislate them a monopoly by making entry into that market prohibitively expensive, or, you know, obviously protecting their patents, then you will end up with a government that, you know, that comes to only serve then the biggest and most powerful corporations in the world. Then that's what we have now. And it's not capitalism anymore, not at the top. If your little mom and pop burger joint goes under, then it just goes under. You don't get a bailout. That's capitalism. But at the top, with like the big banks and financial institutions and even the automakers, you get what the government, they call, you know, the government decides that these industries, they're just too big to fail. That's the watch phrase that gives it away, that you don't have capitalism anymore, you actually have corporatism. If you have companies that are declared too big to fail, which means if they do, like write a bunch of bad loans to people who will never pay them back, and then sell a bunch of investment vehicles based on the interest that those loans will make, even though they're not getting paid back in principle, never mind the interest, and then they go bust. You know, under capitalism, then they would just go bust. Those banks would have all just gone bust, and everybody would have lost their money because they shouldn't have been betting on this risky investment to begin with. But when knowing you're playing with house money, what happens then is the banks go, oh, shucks, we screwed up. And so the government goes, don't you worry, you're too big to fail. And so they rob everybody else who didn't make bad loans and take their money and give them to the banks to recoup and prop themselves up. Because the big banking institutions and financial institutions are part of the oligarchs, are among the oligarchs. You know, they're part of the oligarchy. And that's, you know, an oligarchy is a government for and by a very small few, the oligarchs, and that's what we have. And so that's why the banks get bailed out and your little burger joint won't. So don't go to an all-vegan menu and bet on that somewhere in the Midwest, you know, in a cow town somewhere, okay, and think that, hey, you know, if this doesn't work out, well, I'll just get bailed out, like, you know, Goldman Sachs or anybody else, or, you know, or General Motors, or you name it. No, you won't. So that's not available to you. You're just a peon. You're a, you know, you're a peasant on the tax plantation that is the United States. So yeah, don't do that. There's another good example of where you can see that this is a corporatist oligarchy and not any sort of a representative democracy. We saw how it's not, you know, I just talked to you about how it's not capitalist because we have corporatism. Another way that manifests itself, it's all, we can all think back, you know, most of us remember 10 years ago it was about when the Supreme Court struck down all the state level bans on gay marriage. If you look at the news headlines in the kind of weeks and months leading up to that, it's very interesting. It was right after you know, the news outlets ran stories that some of the major pollsters, like I think it was Gallup, had was getting I think there was a couple of polls that came out right around the same time, actually, that was putting a reliable 51% of Americans in favor of legalizing gay marriage. And it was right, I think it was that very same week then, that Obama comes out and says, well, you know, his at this point now, his opinion, his personal opinion has evolved. Because remember, it was always evolving. You know, he thought it was just between a man and a woman at first, and then it was evolving. And wouldn't you know it, as soon as about 51% of Americans were, you know, coming out polling in favor of legalizing gay marriage, that his opinion on it evolved to, you know, match the majority, which is very convenient. And then it wasn't long after that that the Supreme Court struck down all those bans, and Obama lit the White House up in rainbow colors, like the whole thing was his idea to begin with, and everybody lived happily ever after. You can go on Google right now and find all sorts of stories reporting on multiple polls, reliable pollsters, getting 61% of Americans in favor of legalizing marijuana across the board. 61%, that's 10% more. That's millions more Americans than are in favor, than were in favor of legalizing gay marriage. But the federal government is moving not at all to actually accommodate that. And now, why is that? Well, again, if you look at it from the perspective that you were taught to look at it from, that this is a representative democracy and your voice and your vote actually mattered to anyone, then yeah, that doesn't make any sense at all, does it, right? 61% of Americans, hell, pot should be legal already then, right? That 51%, the Supreme Court was ready to move, you know, on gay marriage. What gives? Well, letting gays get married doesn't really affect the oligarchs. In fact, you know, I mean, on a bare economics perspective, minting more marriage licenses is just more revenue for local government. So, I mean, that's, you know, government never minds making more money off of us serfs by, you know, licensing us rights we already had. So, you know, that's why there was no real resistance there from any of the oligarchs. You know, the big religion, you know, big Jesus hasn't been among the oligarchs in a long time. So, they, you know, their clout's kind of not there anymore. So, nobody cares. That's why that happened. But as I am speaking this right now, Big Pharma is busily trying to isolate and synthesize into pill form the various cannabinoids found in marijuana. That way they can keep the model they have now, where you go to your doctor, complain of a malady, the doctor writes you a prescription for a pill that you have to then buy from this pharmaceutical company, with their patent being protected for a number of years by the government. And that's how, you know, you treat your illness. And the government government makes money, you know, on putting these drugs through the approval process. I mean, it costs hundreds of thousands of dollars just to, you know, fill out the forms and get the ball rolling to get your drug approved. So if instead you could just grow a plant in your basement and then, you know, smoke it, vaporize it, eat it, do whatever you want to do to treat a malady, well, the government doesn't make any money taxing you to do, you know, taxing the plant. It doesn't know you're growing in the basement. Obviously, Big Pharma doesn't make any money because it's not selling you any pills. So this is a big problem for Big Pharma. That's why every time there's a state-level ballot initiative to legalize marijuana, the surprise, surprise, the people spending money, the most money to lobby against it and put out literature and things like that, you know, voter materials, you know, urging people to vote against it, are the big pharmaceutical companies that stand to lose billions and billions of dollars on pills that they could be selling us, and, you know, if these people instead just smoke a plant, or, you know, however, use a plant they grew themselves or bought from somebody down the road that's not, you know, big pharmaceutical company. So that's why they, you know, they lobby to have people have it remain illegal, okay? And, you know, you have to understand that the essence of every law is the gun and the cage. So yes, it's worth it to the big pharmaceutical companies to have the government come along with a gun and put you in a cage for using a plant, because then that, you know, should theoretically deter other people from doing the same. Obviously it doesn't, but it's more worth it to them to have that happen, because they're, you know, otherwise they would lose money on, you know, selling you pills. So that's why that is. And that's the thing we must always remember about any government, is that a government, any government, is just an armed gang with a legal monopoly on the initiation of violence. A monopoly on the legal initiation of violence, right? I can, you know, if I run up and punch you, you know, that's an assault. If a cop does it, you know, he can make up why he did it. You know, if you broke some arbitrary government dictate and didn't immediately, you know, listen to his commands, then you're fair game. Whereas at no point can I actually grab somebody and put them in a cage for transgressing, you know, me and some, you know, or some weird rule I set, you know. So that's all the government is. And that violence is its very essence. And you have to understand that the police are the people on the ground that carry that violence out. That's their job. So yeah, when you look at it from the perspective of, we're a corporatist oligarchy, not a representative democracy that practices capitalism, the refusal of the federal government to do anything to loosen or loosen restrictions on marijuana or legalize it altogether, you know, that not happening makes perfect sense. You know, whereas if you look at it from the way you're taught that this is a representative democracy, you know, that doesn't make any sense at all. I mean, the people have spoken, 61%. Why is it not legal already? Because we're not a representative democracy. We're a corporatist oligarchy, and the corporatists, the oligarchs, you know, Big Pharma, they don't want it legal. So it's not going to be legal. And they will fight like hell at the state level to keep the states from making it legal. And they will make sure that the federal government preserves its bans on it to make life as hard as possible for people who, you know, trade in it or use it or whatever. That's the government's job, you see. That's why, and this is the thought I'm going to leave you with. I chuckle a bit when I, you know, hear people talking about, you know, the government's broken. This government's broken. We got to fix it. We got to fix the government. And that's a very, you know, lovely and noble sentiment. I mean, I appreciate that the speakers at least recognize that something's seriously wrong here. But it's important to understand that the government isn't broken. It's working exactly as it's intended to. Okay? Again, it's not a representative democracy. It's not what you were taught it is. It's not what the government tells you it is. Because you'd be less enthusiastic about supporting it if they told you it was what it is, a corporatist oligarchy that only exists to serve the interests of the oligarchs. And if you're confused for a moment, if you're unsure for even a nanosecond as to whether or not you're an oligarch or a serf, you're a serf. So make no mistake, we're all serfs, and the government is working exactly as it's supposed to. They've been tuning this machine for a long time, at least since the end of World War II, and probably as far back as the creation of the Federal Reserve to begin with. And they've had a long time to work out all the kinks and to get it right. And they've had a long time of controlling the school curriculums to tell us what we need to hear so that it all just flows together seamlessly. And we wake up and we go to work and we pay our taxes and we have kids so they can get up and go to work and pay taxes and keep this machine running. It doesn't have to be this way. I maintain that it definitely shouldn't be, and I maintain that it doesn't have to, and in our lifetimes we can do something about it. And that's really the aim and purpose of this podcast, as it is my blog, is to just alert people to the fact that, hey, there's something really wrong. We've been lied to our whole lives, and we can get together and fix it, but it's going to take actually getting together and fixing it. So I will leave you all with that. Thank you very much, those of you who stuck with it this long. And hopefully, I'll keep doing this for a while. We'll see where it goes. And I will catch you all next time.